day to you, and welcome back to the Cory Doctorow podcast, coming to you from Burbank, California, a state whose president is now apparently Joe Biden, we think. That is, on balance, very good news, although I have major reservations about him. Those reservations are not as significant by a really wide margin as my reservations are about the current president, Donald J. Trump. And so, on balance, I am going to call this a good goddamn day. Tomorrow, Monday, also a good day. Monday, November the 9th, I am speaking at the Reboot Conference put on by the Lincoln Network. I'm on at 12:30 Pacific for a one-on-one discussion with their CTO called How to Fix the Internet. On the 12th of November, that's later this week, I'm on a panel at the Texas Book Festival called Cyber Terrorists, Post-Apocalyptic Landscapes, and Where Pomeranians? You can come along to that. On the 14th of November, I'm giving a speech at 1:30 at Aaron Swartz Day. And on the 16th of November, I'm giving a panel at the Design Thinkers Conference called Let's Talk About Influence. And those and all my other upcoming talks, of which there are so very many, this is an odd season because people can book you in to speak virtually because it doesn't matter so long as you can make the time zones work. And then if you can, you can just record it. Those are all at pluralistic.net. If you just go and click on the see upcoming appearances at the bottom of any edition of it, you'll find them all with links. Not much else to report here. I took down our Halloween decorations and put them away. You'll be satisfied and pleased to hear. If you are a Kickstarter backer, my plan is to push out the FLAC download codes later today or maybe tomorrow, depending on how the day goes. And apart from that, not much else to report. We are moving on to part 22 of my reading of Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town. Thank you for hanging in for all 22 parts. Looking at the scroll bar in the side of my LibreOffice window, it looks like we are now about two-thirds of the way through this book. So assuming all holds, then another 10 weeks or so around the new year, we'll be done with this book. And then I will read you the large backlog of essays and things that have come out since. Here we go then, part 22 of Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town. The game started bang on time at 6 p.m., just as the sun was setting. The diamond lights flicked on with an audible click and made a spot of glare that cast out the twilight. Benny was already on the mound. He'd been warming up with the catcher, tossing them in fast and exuberant and confident and controlled. He looked good on the mound. The ump called the start and the batter stepped up to the plate and Benny struck him out in three pitches and the little ones went nuts, cheering their brother on along with the other fans in the bleachers, a crowd as big as any you'd ever see outside of school, 30 or 40 people. The second batter stepped up and Benny pitched a strike, another strike, and then a wild pitch that nearly beamed the batter in the head. The catcher cocked his mask quizzically and Benny kicked the dirt and windmilled his arm a little and shook his head. He tossed another wild one, this one coming in so low that it practically rolled across the plate. His teammates were standing up in their box now, watching him carefully. "Stop kidding around," Alan heard one of them say. "Just strike him out." Benny smiled, spat, caught the ball, and shrugged his shoulders. He wound up, made ready to pitch, and then dropped the ball and fell to his knees, crying out as though he'd been struck. Alan grabbed the little one's hand and pushed out into the diamond before Benny's knees hit the ground. He caught up with Benny as he keeled over sideways, bringing his knees up to his chest, eyes open and staring and empty. Alan caught his head and cradled it on his lap and was dimly aware that a crowd had formed around them. He felt Benny's heart thundering in his chest and his arms were stuck straight out to his sides, one hand in his pitcher's glove, the other clenched tightly around the ball. "It's a seizure," someone said from the crowd. "Is he an epileptic? It's a seizure." Someone tried to prise Alan's fingers from around Barry's head, and he grunted and hissed at them, and they withdrew. "Barry?" Alan said, looking into Barry's face, that faraway look in his eyes a million miles away. Alan knew he'd seen it before, but not in years. The eyes came back into focus, closed, opened. "Davy's back," Barry said. Alan's skin went cold and he realized that he was squeezing Barry's head like a melon. He relaxed his grip and helped him to his feet, got Barry's arm around his shoulders, and helped him off the diamond. "You okay?" one of the players asked as they walked past him, but Barry didn't answer. The little ones were walking beside them now, clutching Barry's hand, and they turned their back on the town as a family and walked toward the mountain. George had come to visit him once before, not long after Alan had moved to Toronto. He couldn't come without bringing down Elliot and Ferdinand, of course, but it was George's idea to visit. That was clear from the moment they rang the bell of the slightly grotty apartment he'd moved into in the annex, near the students who were barely older than him, but seemed to belong to a different species. They were about 16 by then, and fat as house cats, with the same sense of grace and inertia in their swinging bellies and wobbling chins. Alan welcomed them in. Edward was wearing a pair of wool trousers pulled nearly up to his nipples and short suspenders that were taut over his sweat-stained white shirt. He was grinning fleshily, his hair damp with sweat and curled with the humidity. He opened his mouth and George's voice emerged. "This place is..." He stood with his mouth open, while inside him George thought, "Incredible! I'd never..." He closed his mouth, then opened it again. "Dreamed! What a..." Now Ed spoke. "Jesus, figure out what you're going to say before you say it, will you? This is just plain..." "Rude," came Fede's voice from his mouth. "I'm sorry," came George's voice. Ed was working on his suspenders, then unbuttoning his shirt and dropping his pants so that he stood in grimy jockeys with his slick, tight, hairy belly before Alan. He tipped himself over, and then Alan was face to face with Freddy, who was wearing a t-shirt and a pair of boxer shorts with blue and white stripes. Freddy was scowling comically, and Alan hid a grin behind his hand. Freddy tipped to one side, and there was George, short and delicately formed and pale as a frozen French fry. He grabbed Freddy's hips like handles and scrambled out of him, springing into the air and coming down on the balls of his feet, holding his soccer ball-sized gut over his Hulk underoos. "It's incredible," he hooted, dancing from one foot to another. "It's brilliant. God, I'm never, ever going home." "Oh, yes," Alan said, not bothering to hide his smile as Frederick and George separated and righted themselves. "And where will you sleep then?" "Here," he said, running around the tiny apartment, opening the fridge and the stove and the toaster oven, flushing the toilet, turning on the shower faucets. "Sorry," Alan called as he ran by. "No vacancies at the Hotel Anders." "Then I won't sleep," he cried on his next pass. "I'll play all night and all day in the streets. I'll knock on every door on every street and introduce myself to every person and learn their stories and read their books and meet their kids and pet their dogs." "You're bonkers," Alan said, using the word that the lunch lady back at school had used when chastising them for tearing around their cafeteria. "Easy for you to say," Greg said, stopping in front of him. "Easy for you. You're here, you got away, and you don't have to deal with Davy..." He closed his mouth, and his hand went to his lips. Alan was still young and had a penchant for the dramatic, so he went around to the kitchen and pulled a bottle of vodka out of the freezer and banged it down on the counter, pouring out four shots. He tossed back his shot and returned the bottle to the freezer. George followed suit and choked and turned purple, but managed to keep his expression neutral. Fred and Ed each took a sip, then set the drinks down with a sour face. "How's home?" Alan said quietly, sliding back to sit on the minuscule counter surface in his kitchenette. "It's okay," Ed mumbled, perching on the arm of the Goodwill sofa that came with the apartment. Without his brothers within him, he moved sprightly and lightly. "It's fine," Fred said, looking out the window at the street below, craning his neck to see Bloor Street and the kids smoking out front of the Brunswick house. "It's awful," Greg said, and pulled himself back up on the counter with them. "And I'm not going back." The two older brothers looked balefully at him, then mutely appealed to Alan. This was new. Since infancy, Earl, Frank, Jeff had acted with complete unity of will. When they were in the first grade, Alan had wondered if they were really just one person in three parts. That was how close their agreements were. "Brian left last week," Greg said, and drummed his heels on the grease-streaked cabinet doors. "Didn't say a word to any of us, just left. He comes and goes like that all the time, sometimes for weeks." Craig was halfway around the world. He was in Toronto, and Brian was God knew where. That left just Ed, Fred, George, and Davy, alone in the cave. No wonder they were here on his doorstep. "What's he doing?" "He just sits there and watches us, but that's enough. We're almost finished with school. He dropped his chin to his chest. I thought I could finish here, find a job, a place to live. He blushed furiously. A girl. Ed and Fred were staring at their laps. Alan tried to picture the logistics, but he couldn't really. There was no scenario in which he could see his brothers carrying on with. Don't be an idiot, Ed said. He sounded surprisingly bitter. He was usually a cheerful person, or at least a fat and smiling person. Alan realized for the first time that the two weren't equivalent. George jutted his chin toward the sofa and his brothers. They don't know what they want to do. They think that because it'll be hard to live here, we should hide out in the cave forever. Alan, talk to him, Fred said. He's nuts. Look, George said, you're gone. You're all gone. The king under the mountain now is Davy. If we stay there, we'll end up his slaves or his victims. Let him keep it. There's a whole world out here that we can live in. I don't see any reason to let my handicap get me down. It's not a handicap, Edward said patiently. It's just how we are. We're different. We're not like the rest of them. Neither is Alan, George said, and here he is, living in the big city, living with them, working, meeting people, out of the mountain. Alan's more like them than he is like us, Frederick said. We're not like them. We can't pass for them. Alan's jaw hung slack. Handicapped, passing, like them, not like them? He'd never thought of his brothers this way. They were just his brothers, just his family. They could communicate with the outside world. They were people, different. But the same. You're just as good as they are, he said. And that shut them up. They all regarded him as if waiting for him to go on. He didn't know what to say. Were they really? Was he better? What are we, Alan? Edward said it, but Frederick and George mouthed the words after he'd said them. You're my brothers, he said. I want to see the city, George said. You two can come with me, or you can meet me when I come back. You can't go without us, Frederick said. What if we get hungry? You mean, what if I don't come back, right? No, Frederick said, his face turning red. Well, how hungry are you going to get in a couple hours? You're just worried that I'm going to wander off and not come back, fall in a hole, meet a girl, get drunk, and you won't ever be able to eat again. He was pacing again. Ed and Fred looked imploringly at him. Why don't we all go together, Alan said. We'll go out and do something fun. How about ice skating? Skating, George said. Jesus, I didn't ride a bus for 30 hours just to go skating. Edward said, I want to sleep. Frederick said, I want dinner. Perfect, Alan thought. Perfect. We'll all be equally displeased with this then. The skating's out front of City Hall. There are lots of people there and we can take the subway down. We'll have dinner afterward on Queen Street, then turn in early and get a good night's sleep. Tomorrow, we'll negotiate something else. Maybe Chinatown and the zoo. They stared at him. This is a limited time offer, Alan said. I had other plans tonight, you know. Going once, going twice. Let's go, George said. He went and took his brother's hands. Let's go, okay? They had a really good time. George's body was propped up at the foot of the bed. He was white and wrinkled as a big toe in a bathtub, skin pulled tight in his face so that his hairline and eyebrows and cheeks seemed raised in surprise. Alan smelled him now, a stink like a mouse dead between the gyprock and the walls, the worst smell imaginable. He felt Mimi breathing behind him, her chest heaving against his back. He reached out and pushed aside the wings, moving them by their translucent membranes, finger brushing the tiny fingerlets at the wingtips, recognizing in their touch some evolutionary connection with his own hands. George toppled over as Alan stepped off the bed, moving in the twilight of the light from under the bathroom door. Mimi came off the bed on the other side and hit the overhead light switch, turning the room as bright as an icebox, making Alan squint painfully. She closed the blinds quickly, then went over to the door and shot the chain and the deadbolt closed. Mimi looked down at him. Ugly sumbitch, whoever he was. My brother, Alan said. Oh, she said. She went back around the bed and sat on the edge, facing the wall. Sorry. She crossed her leg and jiggled her foot, making the springs squeak. Alan wasn't listening. He knelt down and touched George's cheek. The skin was soft and spongy, porous and saturated. His fingertips came away with shed white flakes of translucent skin clinging to them. Davy, Alan said, are you in here? Mimi's foot stilled. They both listened intently. There were nighttime sounds in the motel, distant muffled TVs and car engines and fucking, but no sound of papery skin thudding on ground-down carpet. "He must have come up through the drain," Alan said, "in the bathroom." The broad, pale moon of George's belly was abraded in long gray stripes. He stood and, wiping his hand on his bare thigh, reached for the bathroom doorknob. The door swung open, revealing the sanitized for your protection brightness of the bathroom, the water sloshed on the floor by Mimi earlier, the heaps of damp towels. "How'd he find us here?" Mimi, in her outsized blazer and track pants, touched him on his bare shoulder. He suddenly felt terribly naked. He backed out of the bathroom, shoving Mimi aside, and numbly pulled on his jeans and a shapeless sweatshirt that smelled of Mimi and had long, curly hairs lurking in the fabric that stuck to his face like cobwebs. He jammed his feet into his sneakers. He realized that he'd had to step over his brother's body 6 times to do this. He looked at his brother again. He couldn't make sense of what he was seeing. The abraded belly, the rictus, his balls shrunk to an albino walnut, his cock shriveled up to unrecognizability, the hair curly, matted, all over his body, patchily rubbed away. He paced in the little run beside the body, the only pacing room he had that didn't require stepping over George's body, back and forth, 2 paces turn, 2 paces turn. "I'm going to cover him up," Mimi said. "Good, fine," Alan said. "Are you going to be okay?" "Yes, fine," Alan said. "Are you freaking out?" Alan didn't say anything. George looked an awful lot like Davy had the day they killed him. All right, then, there's your cliffhanger for the week. I'll talk to you next Sunday. I hope you're safe and happy and well, celebrating and ready to do the hard work that comes next. Talk to you later.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Sharealike, US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, Ryneck Studio at gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.